are listening to Teacher Toolkit, supporting teachers, parents and students worldwide.
And the bloke you send out in a strange outfit onto the frontier to see who's out there and is it worth going?
We help teachers thrive and survive with classroom ideas, cutting-edge school resources and research-informed teacher training materials. You will also hear discussions on the policy, guidance and research-based publications.
This week, listen to Ross McGill, founder of Teacher Toolkit, interview Andy Hargreaves, researcher, professor, policy advisor and author. Over his career, Andy has taught in multiple countries in the Northern Hemisphere and received multiple honorary doctorates from prestigious universities. In today's podcast, some of the things we'll be discussing are how attitudes towards research and education has changed, why teacher attrition is so high, and how working class communities and education interact.
Could you just introduce yourself to my listeners and tell them what you do and where you do it?
Hello, Ross. My name is Andy Hargreaves. I'm delighted to be interviewed by and conversing with you and for your many listeners. And I am British originally from Accrington in Northern England. I briefly taught primary school, worked in universities in England, then moved to Canada, worked 16 years in Canada, then 16 years in Boston, also as a professor in the United States. Just moved back to Ottawa now, where I'm a part-time professor.
Okay, very nice. So could we go back to that point when we talked about going to university? Could you go back a little bit further and describe your early years in education?
I'm delighted to. I was... anybody who wants to read this in gory detail can pick up a memoir I've written called Moving, which will be published by Solution Tree at the end of this year. I'm trying to find photographs for it now.
Right.
And, so to cut a long story short, I grew up in a working class community in Accrington in the north of England, famous for Accrington Stanley, and Norai bricks that were at the base of the Blackpool Tower and the Empire State Building. They had a great primary education, like lots of kids did then, even in a somewhat struggling community, and went to secondary school, grammar school. I went to grammar school, my brothers didn't. They went to work in factories. One went to a technical school, one went to a secondary modern school. My oldest brother failed the 11 plus because he got accused of cheating because he tried to borrow somebody else's rubber. So he walked out in disgust and he ended up in factories for which he had no talent whatsoever, basically. I went on to grammar school, did very well in my first year. Then my performance plummeted in the next three or four. And I recovered in time for my O-levels, basically because when I was 12, my dad died. And my mum sort of struggled on for a while. She cleaned people's houses, looked after people's children, worked at the local co-op. And eventually got too much, so she collapsed, she had a nervous breakdown. And like many working class kids these days, you suddenly find your parents aren't looking after you, you're looking after them, basically, or you're looking after other family members. So I never got to school before, for months on end, before 11 o'clock in the morning, because my mum couldn't leave the house or get out of bed even. I was awful at maths because I missed all my maths classes. I used to dream about maths till I was in my 60s. I would say, don't now, I'm over that. And so maths, if you wanted to help me with my maths achievement, I didn't need more maths tuition. I needed a school that was able to understand the whole of me, not just a bit of.
So, I think my deputy headship quite recently, where we had loads of kids coming in very last minute at the gates or a bit later, having just dropped their siblings off to the local primary school because mum was working the night shift. We still have the 11 plus today. What are your thoughts on that still, 50 odd years later?
So I'll tell you about the 11 plus in a second, but what I wanted to finish up with on the previous thing is exactly what you've described, which is people in struggling backgrounds who look after family members or neighbours or things like this is often treated as a deficit. And it's not. It's an asset. It's leadership. They don't ask for it. It comes to them.
Yeah.
And it should count. It shouldn't just be excused, but it should count as an asset. Mm. 11 plus these days is all early selection is a terrible idea. The evidence is utterly overwhelming still.
Mm-hmm.
And back in my day, it had all kinds of what are called backwash effects, streaming in primary schools, a grouping of kids. I had my old class list for age 7, and at age 11, the gaps were greater than they were at age 7. That's what the research said then. That's what still happens now. So the later you can select, the better. The longer you can give kids a chance and the right support, the better. We talk about a grammar school system. We don't talk about a secondary modern school system, which is for the other 80% or so. And the OECD's evidence on streaming and tracking is that countries in Europe who delay it till later, the kids do better in terms of equity. So even delaying selection until about 15 or so really seems the way to go.
Yeah. So when you mentioned Hull, where did you go instead?
I went to Sheffield.
Okay.
So I didn't completely get my A-levels the first time round, so I had a second shot. I applied to all universities north of Birmingham except the London School of Economics because I visited my girlfriend in London once after she'd come to college, so I knew London. What I didn't realise when I turned down the London School of Economics, who gave me a fabulous offer, was... I didn't realise part of the idea of going to university was you'd build networks, you'd meet future ministers, journalists. Yeah. I just thought you went to university to study stuff and learn it and get on top of it. But I went to a great university. I went to do geography. I switched in my first year I discovered sociology, and it helped me understand the world and where I was in it, which I've still been trying to do for the last 40 or 50 years or so.
Yeah.
And I met my wife there, so it can't have been a bad thing.
So, and you went into teaching. Where did you first start?
I trained at the Sheffield City College of Education. My teaching practice was in a school just about half a mile away from where they filmed the Full Monty, actually.
Right, okay.
It looks just like that. I went to primary. I thought at first I wanted to be a geography teacher, but I got the good advice that since I hadn't actually studied geography, I'd probably get a job, but I wouldn't get a career.
Right.
So they said, have you thought about primary school? And I hadn't. I had no idea if I'd be any good at it, but I loved it, really. And had a so-so first teaching practice. It was kids were nice. It didn't really set me on fire, and I was good in parts, but not all of them. Second school... was really rough. It was probably the worst school in Sheffield at the time. Mm-hmm. And it, like it does with many people, it brought out the best in me, I think. You know, you realise fairly fast all day the kids are all you've got and you can't muck around, so they need all of you. I then went to teach in the Midlands in a mining community, and loved the teaching, but worked for a head teacher who was crazy. Certifiably, it turned out.
Right.
Okay. he thought my teaching was great. He offered me a promotion to stay on, but we had ridiculous arguments for 6 weeks about whether I ate my school dinner with a fork or not. So he thought that was a bad example for minors' kids if I was not using a fork.
So you disappeared from there as quick as you could.
So I thought, well, I planned actually to leave after 3 years to go and do a master's and think about teacher training. So I thought, well, I'll leave a year earlier, then I'll come back. So I left, and then I got on to doing a master's. Then he talked me into doing a PhD. Didn't really want to, but I thought, nothing to lose. Then I did a bit of part-time work at a teacher's college in the north of Leeds, and they liked what I was doing, so they offered me a job. And like many people's careers, it's not some big sort of master plan at the beginning. You stumble your way through it, and later on, if you're lucky, it makes sense.
So I want to talk about research in a moment, but if you could give any advice to someone that wants to join the profession, what would it be?
Well, first of all, you really have to want to do it.
Because
it's hard enough if you don't. And you're talking about teaching now rather than research as such.
Yes, you're right.
Yeah. So first is you really have to have the fire to want to do it. You have to either have that when you go in, or you have to get it fairly quickly. Once you're in, you have to be in it for the kids and not just your subject and your content, although those are really important. You need a lot of character as well as a lot of knowledge. You have to withstand a lot of things. You have to have a thick skin, and you have to have a lot of empathy for the adults as well as for the kids, actually. And the research is pretty clear, which is turnover teaching in the UK in the first 3 or 4 years is around 40%, I think, now in England. And you find the same patterns in places like Australia. It's worse in the US. One of the things that is most likely to keep you in teaching is your relationship with the adults. So if you work in a very collaborative environment, you get more ideas if you get stuck, and you get moral support if you get down or you find things difficult. So the advice for somebody moving in is try and find a school that's like that. And when they interview you, ask them about that. Don't be shy. And don't be afraid to turn them down if there's lots of jobs out there.
And on the opposite side, with your research and unpicking teacher attrition, what are the typical patterns here as to why teachers might leave?
Teachers feel on their own. They feel overwhelmed. If they if things go badly, they think it's their fault. Sometimes, if things go badly, other people think it's their fault. If they're stuck on their own, there is better mentoring and coaching these days than there used to be. But if the only collaboration there is in a school, you get the idea fairly fast that the only people who need mentoring or coaching are the ones who are new or useless. And if you have a lot of collaboration in the school, it gives the idea that teaching is inherently difficult, like any other profession, and we need to do this together. And there'll be some things that'll be hard for us all to solve, even the most experienced. So the most experienced people in the school need to model that they get stuck with things, have kids they can't deal with easily, and sometimes don't know what to do and need advice from other people about how to do that.
I don't know if you can hear my puppy in the background. We've got our border collie, and she's going a bit crazy whenever the doorbell rings. I'm sure you've visited thousands of schools on your travels, and I'm sure there's one or two that have stuck in your memory throughout your lifetime. Is there any particular reason why, or something that they're doing in a particular way that's resonated?
The first thing when you see a lot of schools, as you will do, Ross, we're like supply teachers, which is, within about 2 minutes, you know whether this is going to be a good school or it isn't. You actually don't need a week to do an inspection. You know how the secretary welcomes you. If the adults say hello to you when you walk in, if the kids say hello to you, do they have an adult show you around, or do they have a child show you around? Are they trying to hide their problems, or are they open about everything? So I think the first thing you pick up is about all schools. There's However it is, the vibe comes through fairly fairly fast. Obviously, when I was to visit schools, it's a bit like being a minister. They take you to the good ones. they don't take you to the ones that
need a bit of help.
That are in a mess or really up against it. But when you're doing research, you say, depending on the research you do, you see all kinds of struggling schools.
Yeah.
A lot of my research has been on, not always, but I did some in the UK a few years ago, on schools that were doing well in particularly challenging circumstances. So what I found about those was how they were now, and sort of the narrative of how they came to be that way, the way people talked about it.
Mm-hmm.
And what I usually picked up is not that great schools are full of technology, beautiful space, lovely lighting, different kinds of seating, only young teachers, no old stagers. But there's a sort of no-nonsense, down-to-earth, hands-in-the-dirt thing about the teachers and the principal. They read a bit, but they don't get carried away with it. They feel they're all in it together. They really care about the kids. They understand that the kids have assets as well as deficits.
Mm-hmm.
That the point is to get the curriculum to fit the kid rather than getting the kid to fit the
curriculum.
Well, I remember a school in the north of England with a large proportion of Bangladeshi kids, and they, with the existing staff actually, not with big new staff, they started to figure out what the kids knew rather than what they didn't know. They found out they were very good in areas like the arts.
Mm-hmm.
So they moved the whole curriculum round towards the arts and away from, you know, literacy, maths and so on. The kids did much better,
mm-hmm.
got all kinds of awards, went to university. So the schools I'm most impressed with aren't fancy-dancy, basically. They're
just gritty.
They're honest people in difficult circumstances who have respect and empathy for the families and kids they work with, but relentlessly keep challenging and stretching them for their own good as well.
Okay. In terms of research, I guess with the birth of the internet, it's changed everything, but is research predominantly the same since when you first started to what it is today? And I guess my second question is, why is it important for teachers to get access to research?
Research, there's all kinds of research is the first thing. I think schools are more aware of research than they used to be. There used to be a kind of polar extreme, I think, 20, 30 years ago, between countries and cultures that reviled research in education, and Britain was definitely one of them, mm-hmm. which is, who are you to come into my school telling me what to do? You need to have been here 20 years and teaching 4D on a Friday afternoon, and then you'll know. There was sort of that approach to research. And America had the opposite, which was they revered research. And so they believed that research knowledge was cast iron, that the evidence would tell you what to do. They try to implement it, but rather than engaging with it critically. And I think in both countries now, we're getting more into a situation where if educators use research, they don't just say, that's great, let's implement it and go ahead. But they'll engage with it and think about it. Mm-hmm. I don't know how it's been in the last year or two,
mm-hmm.
But certainly during the Blair years, one of the better things of the Blair years was building community in schools, having teacher researchers, having mm-hmm. people in some of the larger schools.
Today it's high on the agenda in many schools today, which is great. Right. I would probably say really starting to change in the last 5 years, but you could probably trace it back 10 or 15 at least. But yeah, it's pretty common language now in most places that I visit.
I think there's really a couple of ways of going that overlap. One is the kind of John Hattie Education Endowment Trust, which is we'll do large-scale studies or blind control studies of effect sizes. And then the things that have high effect sizes, we should do them. And the things that have low effect sizes,
we should
leave alone. I think we do need to pay attention to that. But bear in mind that a lot of the research done across lots of studies is 15 years or more out of date. So you're looking at averages of how people used to be 15 years or more ago. So you have to not get too dependent on what are supposed to be the absolute cast iron findings of different pieces of research. The kind of research I'm getting engaged in more and more now is collaborative research. So working with practitioners, teachers, principals, school, local authority staff, and so on, and this is beginning to elevate in terms of the universities as well. So in all fields, not just education, people are starting to shift from the idea of researchers' performance metrics being based on high numbers of scholarly articles, leading to a thing called H Factor, which ranks universities globally and tends to discourage researchers from writing books, writing in the Times Education Supplement or professional magazines, to concentrate only on scholarly articles for their university and their career. And there's a movement, a global movement, actually, to start thinking about knowledge and a valuable knowledge as co-created with the people you work with, not just in schools, but social work.
So I remember something you said to me when we met in March in Switzerland, where you said that your most popular books out of the 30-plus were the ones that you'd written with someone else.
Yeah.
In terms of collaboration,
So I've written 32, or edited. Not all of them did well. Some of them are very forgotten. And but 28 of those now have been with other people. Most of them have been really worth it. Every so often, just like in schools, you have a collaborative relationship, and it's a dog. Actually, that's probably unfair to dogs. But if you have a bad one from time to time, people don't pull their weight or whatever it might be, then don't give up. It's you get a lot done.
So I'm listening to Professional Capital on my podcast in my ears on my travels, and literally I want to write down every sentence. I'm thinking, I wish I could underline something, so I'm having to rely on my ears for things to stick. But tell listeners kind of the headlines from this brilliant book, Professional Capital, that you've written with Michael Fullan.
So the book with Michael actually started as a second edition of a book we wrote in 1990. And the publishers really wanted us to do a second edition, and we had a number of false starts at it. The publishers were keen. They said second editions sell a lot more than first editions, and the first edition had sold over 100,000. So we kept trying at it and failed, and the reason was we were doing it for the wrong reason. Then because of what was happening, particularly in the US, but also the UK, we got very angry with the movement that public education was being driven by people who wanted to make profits from schools or lower the cost of public education so that more tax money could go into the private sector rather than the public sector. And we didn't know what to call this, so we came up with a name called business capital. And we said that really business capital is not what should be driving public education, turning local authority schools into academies or public schools into charter schools in the US. But really, it should put the point of public education is to give all kids an opportunity and to contribute to public good. And for that, you need a strong teaching profession. There was a lot of literature influential with governments on human capital, saying it was really just all about picking your best people with a good background, who had a passion to give 2 or 3 years to teaching, knew their stuff. This is the teach first model. Train them a bit, but not too much, over the summer, not like full training in a university and so on. And then most of them will give you 2 or 3 years, and they'll give you everything they've got, and then they'll move on to something else.
Yeah.
Then you'll get another cheap bunch who will give you another 2 or 3 years, and that was the human capital model.
Mm-hmm.
And they really looked at human capital differently than just what your knowledge and your passion is. And we said there are two other things other than how you are as an individual. Second is how you are over time. So the evidence was, not in the US but elsewhere, if you stay in teaching, the longer you stay in teaching, if you get good mentoring and coaching and professional development, the better you'll get. So you don't let people go after 3 or 4 years because it's a waste of your investment. You keep growing them, developing them, moving them on. They may stay teachers, they may become head teachers, they may become professors, but they'll stay connected within education.
Mm-hmm.
And the key one was social capital, which is how we are together, collaboratively, that adds value in all kinds of ways to human capital. So it's these three things that all matter. You can see how they work in places like Finland or Singapore, for example. Human capital, which is bringing not really your absolutely top graduates, but good graduates with good skills into teaching, keeping them there, moving them on, supporting them, and getting them to work together.
So where does your connection with Michael come from, work that you did a long time ago together?
Michael, in a sense, hired me when I moved to Canada. So it was a bit of a risk. My references from England said I was I had a lot of talent, but I was a bit raw. what they meant was, at the age of 37, I didn't really know how a shower worked. I'd only once been abroad. I was a working class kid who just like worked really hard, but didn't have a lot of polish or finesse.
Yeah,
and it probably also meant I was a bit argumentative sometimes,
right, okay.
And still am.
Yeah,
but I went to work in Ontario and also in Canada, and Michael in particular was became the dean, and he was very good at building relationships with the field that I'd always been interested in. And working collaboratively, which I was, but had found it hard to get in England. And Canada was a very collaborative culture. So an odd thing I found after I moved was that at first when I went, all my body gestures were like Tony Blair. They were all like sharp movements of my hands. And after about a year and a half in Canada, I found out I was making all these rounded gestures with my hands, kind of welcoming, inviting people in.
Yeah.
So something definitely very different about the culture as well as about Michael in particular.
And your interest in sociology, trying to find your own space in the world, I guess that's the influence from the sociological side of the book?
The
social capital part element of the book.
I did an undergraduate dissertation on sewer surveys. So 20% of my degree was based on an original dissertation. I was in a work group over the summers that surveyed the sewers in Accrington create a sewer map of Accrington.
Brilliant.
Stay with me a minute, Ross. This will be relevant. Don't worry. And we had a team of four students who did this. Two of them measured the height of the sewers above sea level. You do about 40 or 50 a day.
Yeah.
One of you went down the sewers while the other one drew a map from what the one at the bottom shouted up. And then he connected all this data later on. But the teams rotated. And in these teams, there were people who liked each other, people who hated each other, and people who were in between.
Mm-hmm.
And so the study was of the relationship between friendship and productivity.
Okay.
And the results don't matter, except the fact that the antagonism got the greatest productivity, but we'll not go there.
Right, okay.
Two things came out of it. One is, the people who were friends were not always the most productive, so collaboration is about a lot more than friendship.
Yeah.
And secondly, there's a long tradition called human relations in management, which is that In 1939 in Chicago, they did a study called the Hawthorne Studies, and they tried to manipulate light and heat to see if it increased productivity. But no matter what they did, the productivity still went up because no one had ever taken an interest in them before.
Right.
And that became known as the Hawthorne effect,
yes,
or the halo,
it, yeah.
the halo effect.
Yeah.
So for a long time, just intellectually, I've been interested in the relationship between social relations and, productivity. And then I went on to do a PhD that turned out to be by accident on middle schools.
Right.
And the ideology of middle schools at the time, which I supported, was that they gave kids a smooth transition between the whole class teacher of primary school and the subject specialists, an anonymous environment of secondary schools. And middle schools are supposed to be this nice, smooth zone in between.
Yeah.
And when we studied them, they were worse, actually, than primary schools and secondary schools, because teachers were influenced by not just the kind of teachers they were, but the kind of teachers they used to be. So ex-primary teachers taught like primary teachers, mm-hmm. and ex-secondary teachers were more like secondary teachers than secondary teachers were.
Right.
Because they wanted to be seen as real secondary teachers.
Okay, yeah, of course.
So jump for kids was bigger than it was between...
Yeah, it's interesting. I've got a colleague at Cambridge who's her research, her doctorate is in all through schools. I believe there's 163 in England.
Yeah.
Which I think was a byproduct of the white paper in 2010, where there was an opportunity to create new schools for three or four-year-old up to 18. And her initial data is suggesting that there's no slump in year 6 to 7 because the kind of trajectory can continue with the same teachers in the institution, which is interesting. I've got three final big questions for you.
But let me just conclude one thing before your three final questions. What I learned from that study is that is really two things. First of all, you have to understand why teachers teach the way they do. And instead of perseverating on why teachers don't do something else, even if you don't like the way they're teaching, you have to understand there's usually good reasons why people teach the way they do.
Mm-hmm.
And a big part of that good reason, with the way anybody works the way they do, is what's the background? What's their identity?
Yeah.
You know, who do they identify with amongst other teachers? What's their career path? Where do they see themselves going and moving? And particularly, what cultures have they been in? Because we are a product of who we're with.
Yes.
So that's really when I got interested in cultures of teaching. And mm-hmm. once you get all that and you can understand why people do what they do, mm-hmm. you've got a better chance of figuring out why we together need to do something different.
Yeah, so that takes me to my key question on education. If I could put you in the corner and say what would be the one thing that you'd like to see change in the system, about if we just focus here on England, what would it be?
If you're going to focus on England, I can think of lots of things as you do, because you know I know a bit of what you do, Ross, and I'd say it is to view schools as not only serving a private good of opportunities for individuals, but serving a public good of building communities and societies.
Yeah.
So we studied Hackney a few years ago,
mm-hmm.
as which you know was one of the most turnaround local authorities in England. And one of the transformations in Hackney was getting the schools to work together even when they were competing.
Mm-hmm.
And the result was parents stopped taking the kids out of Hackney and kept their kids in Hackney.
Mm-hmm.
So not only did the schools get better, but the communities got stronger as well, because people saw themselves not just it's about this child and this opportunity, but it's about all the kids and the community, especially those that have the least going in their favour.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's where a lot of teachers already are.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's why they come into the work. And we need to honour that. And we need to put a lot of support behind that. And then we need leaders at all levels, in schools, but also in government, who can really indicate that the world is off its axis. It really is.
Yeah.
And one of the ways we get it back on is by how we educate the generations and the leaders of the future. And so I'd say over and above everything else, that leads you to more equity, less privatization, more connection to your community, and a strong teaching profession that can move all that forward.
Brilliant. I could listen to you all day. I'm going to have to dash shortly. What would be your top tip for teachers, starting with research? Where to go, a website? What would be your starting point, one piece of advice?
Whether it's research or not, be curious always about what you're doing. Curiosity is a huge thing. And be curious not only about why it's going badly, but also about why it's going well. When we look at data-driven improvement, we spend too much of our time thinking only about the ambers and the reds, and not enough time also thinking about the greens, which is why things are going well. So when I'd say, actually, counterintuitively, the hardest thing to be curious about is what's going well when it's going well. Mm. When we move knowledge around, we tend to do it fairly simplistically. So even in things like Teach Meet, somebody will get up, make a few minutes presentation.
Yeah.
Somebody else will think, fabulous, let's go off and do that. What you really need to do is get engaged. So that's interesting and it seems to work. I wonder why it's working. Why it's working there? How can it work for me?
Yeah.
So when you're curious and you're interested in something, say a lesson study or self-regulated learning for kids, don't just look at one example, because your colleagues will either copy it and then get disappointed, or they'll reject it because they think it's in the wrong kind of school with the wrong kind of people. Mm-hmm. But look at two or three examples and try and pick out what are the core principles behind all of them, and what's a couple of practices you can pick up and use. And then that empowers you together, not alone, but together as a group, to think, okay, this looks like it's got legs on it. Mm-hmm. How can we make it work for us in our own classrooms, in our own school? So I'd say curiosity and engagement.
That's a good thing. Nice. My brain's buzzing here. All right, I think I've got a sense of your motivations, you know, your own childhood, your education. But where do you get your inspiration from? What do you do?
I get my inspiration from three things. I've always wanted to change the world. From, like, when I was seven, really.
Yeah.
Sometimes that was very annoying for other people, particularly my teachers. But I still do. I've lived long enough to have a bit of a platform to be able to do that. So I convene a group of nine countries every year, their ministers and teacher leaders, to promote broad excellence, equity, inclusion, democracy, and human rights. But, you know, I used to do it with classes of kids and then with schools of teachers. And so I think that's that is a big thing that keeps me going.
Mm-hmm.
And when I talk with Michael Fulham, which we do almost weekly, the way I distinguish what I do and what he does is I say, look, Michael, the thing is, you're the governor, I'm the pioneer. So I'm the bloke you send out in a strange outfit onto the frontier to see who's out there and is it worth going and is it safe? And then if I'm still alive after I've been, I'll come back and you'll say, okay, this looks like a good way to go. Now let's build some roads and sewers and get some people in and settle them down and get some governance.
It's a nice analogy.
I get very excited by going into schools, working with teachers, and seeing things I've never seen before.
Yeah.
And figuring out with them what it means and what's good about it and what we should be worried about and engaging with them around those kind of questions.
Yeah. Lovely. Andy, I can't wait to play this back and listen to it myself. And I want to just say thank you for being a small part of my new book, as my deadline looms imminently. Thank you for your time. I hope you have a bit of time to have a full breakfast now.
thanks, Ross. You're doing a great job. You have a terrific following. And you believe passionately in what you're doing, and you suffer no fools, which both of which are... great qualities that mean a lot to me.
Thank you very much, Andy. I'll speak to you soon. All the best.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
If you want to find out more about Andy Hardgreaves, you can keep up with him on Twitter at HardgreavesBC. Or if you're interested in buying some of his books or looking at his writing, you can go to andyhardgreaves.com.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To continue the conversation, head over to www.teachertoolkit.co.uk and our social media channels to access all the links and resources mentioned on today's show. Why not share this with your colleagues and give them the gift of time, reduced workload, and increased impact? Until the next time, before you look after your students, look after yourself.